Welcome to the Being Human podcast, brought to you by Relate Malaysia. Join us in our conversations about what makes us human and why we think and behave in the ways that we do. We'll talk about mental health, emotional well-being, and how we can sometimes feel on top of the world, and other times like life calls for a large tub of ice cream and a big spoon. So come on in, relax, and let's explore this puzzle of being human together.
Hello and welcome to the Being Human podcast. My name is Dr. Chua Suk Ning, and today I'm joined by Dr. John Wilson, who is the Director of Bereavement Service at York St. John University. John is recognized as an expert in bereavement counseling, delivering talks and trainings internationally, and researching extensively on the nature and processes of grief and bereavement. He is the author of two popular books on grief, Supporting People Through Loss and Grief, An Introduction for Counselors and Other Caring Practitioners, and The Plain Guide to Grief, which guides readers on managing their grief following a life-changing loss. While grief is a universal experience we'll all encounter at points in our lives, there are some interesting cultural differences in terms of how loss is viewed and the kind of expectations placed on people in terms of how they should manage their grief. So we'll be touching on this and more in the discussion to come, which I'm sure will shed some much needed light on an important topic. Welcome to the show, John. How are you?
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
I feel like my welcome to the show was so upbeat in comparison to a very somber topic on grief. You were just telling me a story about client that you saw and how even moments in the session, there were genuine laughter and jokes. But I think when we think about bereavement counseling or dealing with grief, we think about that we just have to cry and be very sober and somber. And so maybe you can start with telling us, what does bereavement counseling actually look like? How are you laughing in session?
Bereavement counseling is really about being the person that the client needs. And so sometimes it might be very somber, it might be very sad, it might be concentrating a lot on the sadness and sometimes their anger, sometimes their frustration. Sometimes it can be anger with the medical treatment they've received after a suicide. It can be anger with the person that has taken their own life. So it's really about connecting with the client and being what it is that they need you to be. Yeah, sometimes it can be somber, but sometimes there can be laughter. And sometimes I think when you've been working with somebody for a long time and you begin to form that relationship, there can be moments of laughter. I've met clients that found moments of laughter in the absolutely most tragic circumstances, and they've shared that with me in the first session. So it's about being flexible, I think.
My old psychoanalyst supervisor once said to me, "Suk, one of your greatest strengths is your sense of humor. It's a great defense mechanism." And it's true. I feel like, you know, while we go through difficult things, if we could find some space to look at our experiences from a different angle, it's helpful to process it rather than seeing it only from one way. And it's strange because I don't want to take it. I don't want to say, I don't want to dismiss it, but I find sometimes even in my darkest moments, if I take a step out, I find myself a little ridiculous, you know, and just if I can just look at that and sort of find some humor in that, not putting myself down, but just then it helps alleviate some of the distress. I don't know whether that's your experience with humor.
I can think about one particular, we do quite a lot of work in groups online, and certainly through the COVID pandemic, we supported a lot of people in group work because they came from all over the country and no way we could have met face to face. And I won't go into the details, but there was one person in the group that was being stressed out by a neighbour, and she didn't find it funny, but everybody else in the group did. And gradually she could see the funny side of things, and it helped her. So I think sometimes just the thing about humour is it's coming at something from a different direction and seeing a different side. So nobody was laughing at her, but they were laughing at the neighbour and the circumstances. Mm-hmm. And it really did help. And it became a kind of running joke so that people would refer to it, back to it in future sessions. And so it was that moment of levity, of just lifting things a little bit, that was really important in that group.
So we're talking about bereavement, but is that the same as grief or mourning? And like, are they all the same concept?
No. There's three different things. Bereavement is simply what happens to you. And it comes from an ancient English, an old English word, berithian, which meant to kind of tear people away and to rob and to plunder. It was a violent word, so to be taken away. So bereavement is what happens to you. You feel robbed, you feel plundered. Grief is your human, personal response to it. But it varies a little bit, because in the UK, we tend to think of grief and mourning as two different things. So grief is a kind of personal experience, and mourning is something that you do more publicly, and it might be concerned with rituals and so on. Now, certainly in America, they don't make that distinction, and so they'll often talk about mourning somebody, where in the UK, we talk about grieving, where the Americans talk about mourning. So there's a kind of crossover between grief and mourning, but generally, we like to think of mourning as being more public and any rituals that you do, whereas mm-hmm. grief is a much more personal thing.
So why isn't it called grief counseling? You know, if that's the personal experience that you're dealing with clients, rather than bereavement, which is, you're saying, is sort of the event that happens.
I often do call it grief counseling. Okay. I think the reason probably is that in the UK, historically, that bereavement counselling has grown up through the hospice movement, and it's usually run by volunteers, and some of those volunteers are not necessarily counsellors. So it's often called bereavement support, and bereavement counselling really has come around from that kind of bereavement support model, which sometimes can include a social work model, because in hospices, sometimes the bereavement support is offered by social workers rather than the counsellors. So I think the word bereavement has really come out of it historically, but I do often talk about grief counselling or grief therapy.
One of my biggest loss past couple of years was actually during COVID time. My late therapist passed away. During COVID, she was quite elderly. And it was like a shock because, you know, we had a session and the next thing I knew was it was cancelled. And the next thing I knew was I was notified of the death. So very sudden. But I feel like I coped with it. And so that we all need, you know, grief counselling. Do we all need to talk to someone through that, you know, through our losses?
No, there's a lot of work being done by an American called George Bonanno, and he looked at different people's trajectories of their grief. And other people have approached it, other researchers have approached it from different angles as well. But the consensus, the research consensus, is around about half of bereaved people don't need any professional help at all. And it's a conclusion that I've reached independently of anybody else's research. George Bonanno came out with a figure of 48%, but it's around about half of people are resilient. They manage perfectly well. Grief is a kind of normal, natural, healthy process. When my parents died 2 years apart, I didn't have any counselling. I didn't feel any need for any counselling. And that's quite a common pattern. There's about 30% of people, or maybe it's a little bit more than that, 30, 35% of people that don't need very much. They just need reassurance. And it might be from a religious person. It might be from a friend. It might be somebody that's a volunteer. But they don't need really specialist help. And then there's the remaining population. And the figures vary between 5 and 15%, depending on which book you read. they often do need really specific help, sometimes psychiatric help. And they're the people that get labelled with complicated grief. Mm-hmm. And so most people don't need it. Personally, I think the figure of people that need psychiatric help is probably very low. Probably around about 10, 15% of people can be helped by seeing somebody that's got some training in bereavement work.
I imagine that if anyone listening to this podcast would say, I am one of the 50%. I'm the person who doesn't need any help. You know, I'm not the 5 to 15%, you know, those guys, they need psychiatry. How do we know when we need counseling? If there's also that stigma of that on, but we just generally want to be resilient. We want to see ourselves as resilient persons. So is there a sign that says that it'd be helpful for us to talk to someone?
I think sometimes friends and family know before we do. And I think sometimes friends and family will say, you're not behaving right. You need some professional help. And so sometimes friends and family spot it. Sometimes it comes out in kind of subtle ways. So, for example, I worked with one woman who didn't think she needed help, but 12 years after her husband died, she'd begun to feel strange. And she went to the doctors because she felt strange. And it's sometimes people say, I just don't feel right. So it's almost like as if you do need it, eventually it will catch you up. And it doesn't matter whether that's 5 years, 10 years or 30 years, it catches you up eventually. I think mostly people do know, but they try and push it aside. They try to ignore it. But we shouldn't be in any hurry. I don't think we should be in any hurry to offer people bereavement or grief counselling, because we need to give it time to settle. You know, sometimes people are panicky and they feel this is dreadful and they're not going to cope. And some people kind of rush and ask for grief counselling, bereavement counselling, and actually they probably don't need it. So we like to kind of wait for time and meet those people, reassure them, say, you know, it'll probably be okay, but we'll keep an eye on you and we'll time it for when you do.
So what's the time? Because you're talking like 5, 10 years. That's a long time. You know, so like, is there I mean, we're all different, right? We all grieve in different ways, but is there something that I go, okay, if this amount of time has passed and you're still feeling out of sorts or feeling like something's not quite right, then you know, you might benefit from grief counselling.
A lot of the research points to 6 months. Now, I think that's probably a little bit, it's kind of certainty in that, kind of research certainty in that. I think we need to be a little bit flexible. I don't like to see anybody to start counselling till at least 3 months have passed. I might meet them sooner if they're feeling panicky and they're feeling anxious. I might meet them to reassure them, but I wouldn't want to start formal counselling. So a rule of thumb is somewhere between 3 months and 6 months.
So 12 years is very long.
Yeah, but it gives people time to settle into their grief rather than kind of rush at it.
What would happen? I mean, if we generally don't turn away clients when something bad happens, right? And somebody wants to come and talk to us. We don't go, okay, no, you manage on your own. Come back to me later. Generally, we say, okay, you're in distress. We will help you. So why not just see anyone, even if it's like been just a month? Is there a downside to that?
I think there probably is a downside. I think on one occasion, I suspect I made the mistake of feeling sorry for the person and seeing them too soon. And I saw them for a long time and I'm not sure that I helped them in any way at all, really. And I've always wondered, was it because I saw them too soon? It's what it's about, I think, and other researchers have looked at this, because we know from statistical results that people are not helped in the first 6 months, but that doesn't account for the individual and it doesn't really explain why. I think it's to do with the fact that grief is a normal, natural, healthy process and people need to go through those periods of of ignoring their grief, getting on with things, learning to be resilient and managing it in their own way. And I think sometimes a professional intervention can interfere with that process. Okay, it disrupts a natural process, maybe by forcing the person to face up to the reality sooner than they were ready to do. A good case can be made for pretending it hasn't happened, for distracting yourself. It's what I did when my parents died, was I just didn't, you know, I pretended they were still alive, but I didn't see them very often anyway, because we lived 100 miles apart. And so I could pretend until I got used to the idea. And so, you know, a lot of people talk about denial and it's not healthy, but actually distracting yourself until you get used to the idea can be quite useful, and counseling might stop that happening.
I mean, that makes sense to me. I was talking to my therapist. I was coming to terms with a chronic illness I had, and I asked him, is it okay that I ignore it or avoid it, avoid thinking about it, and I just want to live normally? And we come from a perspective where avoidance is seen as a bad thing, right? We always have to face up something, face your emotions. And he's like, nope. And he had cancer, and his cancer was quite severe. And so he understood where I was coming from, that we don't want it in our face all the time. And it's just nice to feel like we don't have that burden, you know, that we're not carrying that wound. But yeah, there's something about that in what you're saying, that it almost sounds like it's a process to acceptance rather than avoidance as a stop in itself.
The classic model that is used, certainly in the West, but I think it's got implications for international implications, but it's called the dual process model. It was invented by Margaret Stoiber and Henk Schut at the University of Utrecht in the Netherlands. They came up with this model in 1999 because they'd looked at different cultures around the world, and they'd observed that some cultures, that grief is kind of really important and it's kind of central to the culture. And in other cultures, grief is quite short duration and so on. And so they also found that if you watch people's grief, that then a lot of people do distract themselves. They came up with a dual process model, which is spending some time distracting yourself, getting on with things, trying to get your life back to normal, and other times where you center yourself on your grief and you're tearful and you think about the person you've lost. But the people that cope best can oscillate, can zigzag between the two places. So they can spend some time grieving and some time ignoring the loss and distracting themselves and getting on with things. Now, some people get stuck. They get stuck either completely on their grief, or they get stuck completely on their avoidance. And counselling is often about, if you've got somebody avoidant, helping them face the reality, whereas sometimes if you've got somebody completely centred on their grief, then it's really helpful to give them ideas of other things to do, interests to do, things, hobbies, interests, going out, meeting other people, so on. And each person has a kind of natural balance of which side they need to spend most time on. Some people do need to spend more time grieving. Other people need to spend more time distracting. So when I first meet somebody, if they've come for counselling, probably too early, I give them a copy of that model and say, look, this can be really useful in adjusting life. And it's an important part of the second book that I wrote as well. It's in there as well. It's really important for people to be able to find their own balance and to move between the two.
Right. It's a really a real trust in the organismic process, right? It's not saying like we have this, you know, the very popular model of stages of grief, and we have like go this one, and then like we got a denial one, and then we got the anger one, and this one. It seems like you're saying we can trust ourselves to figure out that balance and what we need.
I do. I mean, if there's one single piece of advice that I give clients, it's always trust yourself and trust your instincts, because you will know how you need to grieve. And quite often other things get in the way of that. Families get in the way of it. Experts get in the way of it. cultures definitely get in the way of it. You know, there's some very, very sad stories from various cultures where the cultural aspects of their loss have been really harmful to them. And so it was really important that people kind of find the strength to do it their way.
Is there an example of what would be a harmful cultural practice?
Yeah. And that one that has really kind of struck home with me, and it's obviously kind of one that's central to kind of world news at the moment. And I discovered this some time ago, and sadly, I can't remember the author's name. What she did was she interviewed 16 Palestinian mothers of Palestinian sons that had been killed in a conflict with Israel a few years ago now. And she found that a lot of them were prevented from expressing their grief because they were expected to be rejoicing that their sons had become martyrs. And so their religious leaders were telling them, you mustn't grieve publicly. Your son has gone to heaven. He's a martyr. But at the same time, he'll be sitting on his own. He won't be able to eat with the other martyrs. And so using the kind of culture as a lever. And so a lot of these poor mothers were kind of disenfranchised in their grief as a result of the kind of religious insistence of some of the leaders. And another one that comes from Bali, which has been used a lot in bereavement research. It's often taught that people in Bali have a very short duration of grief. But if you actually read the original research on which that is based, what you find is that that isn't necessarily true. But grief is driven underground by the culture. And so if you interview people who've been bereaved, they will say, I want to be tearful, but there's a cultural expectation that I can't be tearful because the spirits will be bad and it will bring bad luck on the family and the person that's died. Again, people can be disenfranchised in their grief because of the cultural teachings and cultural expectations.
One thing I was thinking about as you're talking about that is almost, are we talking about they weren't allowed to mourn? Versus, you know, am I not allowed to my own private feelings, right? Because is that what you say? Because let's say I can't be sad in front of everyone, but it's the culture also saying that I can't even be sad alone. Is that the same impact?
I don't know, because it isn't made public, so it's really difficult to find out. I imagine that in many, many cultures, people in the privacy of their own bedroom, they grieve as they need to. But as soon as other family members are around, or if they're in a public situation, then they have to stop that.
I guess it's saying that it's not enough just to grieve alone. Is it that there's something about being allowed to show what's going on in public, like to mourn publicly, that's part of the healing process.
Yeah, there's a lovely book written by one of the authors is Brenda Koo, and she's at the university in Hong Kong, and she's connected to the hospice in Hong Kong. And she tells a really sad story of a woman diagnosed with cancer in the hospice in Hong Kong. But because in her culture, in traditional Chinese culture, it was considered to be unlucky that she took herself away. She was already widowed and she took herself away and her family were frantic trying to find her. And she found a bedsit and she found somewhere to live, but her family wanted to be with her. But, you know, sometimes cultural expectations can be really damaging to individuals.
But modern culture, because you also wrote an article about gender, about men and women and how they grieve differently and how widowers have a shorter lifespan than men who haven't lost their wives. And I guess this difference is not found among women. Could you talk a little bit about that, like what's happening for men?
I can only talk about it from a Western perspective, because this is something I've looked at. And I can really only talk about it probably from a British and possibly American perspective. But I think one of the things that happens is that men are not good at looking after their own health. So when their wife dies, they don't keep hospital appointments, they don't eat properly, they don't exercise, they sometimes can become depressed in their loneliness and so on. And so they can sometimes even be suicidal, or they can take to alcohol. And so there's lots and lots of reasons why actually the mortality rate goes up in men for the first 6 months after they're bereaved of a spouse. So I think that's probably the main reason, I think. Whereas in some cultures, men are expected to try to get on with things, or they probably do far better. So I don't know how widespread that is in, for example, Asian cultures, whether or not men suffer in the same way. But certainly, you know, I've done some teaching on men's health in the West.
I hear a lot from therapists that grief is scary to deal with, you know, and they feel that they need really specialized training. What kind of training do you think people doing grief counseling actually need? Like, is it so different from what we usually do? Do you need to have an experience of great loss yourself to be able to be helpful?
No, I think an experience of loss can be unhelpful, to be honest. I think it's really important that if you've had an important loss yourself, that you're aware of the risk of putting that onto your clients. And what worked for you won't necessarily work for your clients. So I think there's a risk in that. Many years ago now, 40 years ago, I lost a son when he was a baby. I would never dream of telling anybody how to grieve for a child. And I have to kind of put that out. If I'm working with somebody that's lost a child, I have to put that out of my mind because it isn't relevant. What do I think is necessary? I think not everybody can do it. I do know quite often that people start to do grief work and they can't stick at it. They do find it difficult. I think you need quite a lot of ability to kind of self-care, ability to kind of switch off as well, ability to leave your client in the therapy space and not take them out with you. I think all of that is important. But also what we've discovered, and it's a delightful discovery, is that people like to be taught about the models of grief, the different aspects of grief. And there's been some research done in America on this as well, that psychoeducation is really useful. There's two things, I think, that if people learn nothing else about bereavement counselling, one is people do need to understand the various models of grief and examine them critically and then use them when appropriate with clients. But also, I think people need to be aware of their own stuff, their own reactions to loss. To know yourself, I think, makes it a lot easier than being caught out. And also, I think you need a good care network as well. There's something about working in an organisation where you've got other people that you can talk to and debrief with. And it's really important to negotiate confidentiality with your client so that you can say, I'm part of an organisation, we have team confidentiality, and which means we talk to other people in confidence within the team. And I've always found that really helpful so that you're not carrying stuff that you can't share. Somebody else. You can share it with your supervisor, obviously, but sometimes it needs to be, you know, quite immediate. I mean, I've come out of some sessions really feeling tearful about the client, and it's been great to have colleagues that I could go straight to and say, this was a tough session.
And grief is heavy, but we're talking about grief as only the loss of someone important. But grief now is used as a word for all sorts of other losses, you know, would that be helpful, or are we only talking about the loss of someone?
No, I think it's really helpful. And certainly in the second book I wrote, we've looked at other losses as well. We've looked not just pets, but divorce and separation and redundancy and retirement and life limiting illnesses and so on. So they're all in the book as well. The one model of grief that finds all of those is called assumptive world theory. And assumptive world theory was invented in 1971, was put together by Colin Murray Parks, who sadly died about a month ago. Colin is a psychiatrist, and he worked with people that sometimes had had an amputation or radical surgery, and he noticed that their grief was very similar to the grief of bereavement. And he worked out, well, it can't be to do with attachment. It's not that you loved your limb or your breast or whatever the surgery was with. There must be something else going on. And he came up with the idea that you have a world of certainty. We live in a world, a personal world, where we have expectations and we make assumptions and so on. And that any kind of sudden change, radical change, threatens that security. It threatens all the assumptions that we can make. It shatters our assumptions. And so I've found it really useful sometimes to teach clients assumptive world theory. I worked with a woman that was in remission from breast cancer. And what was really helpful to her was to understand why she was grieving, because she'd been kind of strong and not grieving all the way through the treatment. Here she was 5 years on, apparently cancer-free, but she was starting to grieve. And so it helped her to look at all the things she'd lost as a result. So again, it's that element of psychoeducation. So, but I think what brings together all losses is assumptive world theory. Really helpful to people to know that.
Yeah, I mean, it resonates with my own experience, because how I understood it was I was grieving a path of potential. It's not that I lived that life without chronic illness, because this is the reality I have, but I had to grieve and kind of let go of, I guess, the dreams or the fantasies associated with that, sort of full health. It happens even for other things, like I'm getting older and I'm not married yet, right? And so also kind of letting go of certain paths and having to grieve that and sort of be okay with the reality that we do have, you know, and the life that we are living, rather than kind of always looking at the potential, you know, that other possibility, the other possible world, you know, really sounds like it's kind of similar to what you were saying.
It is. Yeah, it is. And of course, when people are bereaved, they're not just grieving for what they've lost. They're grieving for the future that won't now happen.
Exactly.
And I think in some ways it makes losing a partner or a child when you're young, you know, losing a partner when you're young and they were young, and losing a child, I think it's that a lot of the grief is about what will never happen.
The future, right? We kind of having to let go of that as well.
Yeah. Actually, in terms of illness, there's some research being done by someone in America that I've not really followed up yet. And I don't know whether it was just their idea or whether other people have talked about that. But it's the concept of infinite grief. So that if you've got a progressive illness, that aspect is never going to get better. And so your grief is infinite. It can never come to an end because your condition can only get worse.
Until I die. It's not that.
Yes.
Hopefully. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Infinite sounds very hopeless to me. I don't want to keep grieving.
No, I've yet to explore it. Somebody sent me an article in a social work journal, and I've not had time to kind of process it yet, but I think something interesting about the concept, but
right. I guess it's interesting if it progresses, right? If it gets worse, and rather than like a illness that has stabilized, then it's easier to come to terms with, because you're not losing more and more of yourself.
And I think from a personal perspective, I've got a degenerative eye condition, which could eventually lead to me not being able to drive, not being able to read easily and so on. And I might have to get all sorts of adaptations on computers and so on. But there's no point in dwelling on that, because it's about living now, about mindfulness and the idea of meditation, that you live for now. There's no point in dwelling on that.
Yeah, it's use what you have now. I mean, otherwise, I think, and you do see this with people, even with hip fractures, right? Like the life that they could have is lost. The life that they do have right now has changed. Mm. And then they lose even more and more and more. And, you know, some people actually can die fairly quickly because of such depression, you know, and they stop using anything that they have. So I can see why. I mean, this is getting me down, John. So what? Tell me. Why are you doing such depressing work? You know, like what helps keep you here, and what's the joy that you get out of it?
It isn't depressing work because nearly always, I mean, I must have worked with hundreds of people. I've been doing this for 25 years. I can literally count, not quite on one hand, but I think it's about six people in all those years that I don't feel that I help. And now, with the benefit of research, I'm about to embark on doing some work that I think might even help people like that. It's very joyful work a lot of the time, because you do see people. Sounds a bit cliched phrase, but you do see people getting their lives back, and people do say to you, I don't know where I'd be without this. It's been so important to me to do this. So there is something really joyful about the work. It's not depressing. Sometimes the first two or three sessions can be really depressing, but that hope develops quite quickly.
I mean, it really speaks to that humans in general are resilient, you know, even the 5 to 15%, right? That hope can return fairly quickly, despite the lady you talked about, like 12 years of pushing it away or not dealing with it or, you know, sort of grieving it and maybe in an unbalanced way. And a relatively then short period of time, hope returns. But what's that hope about? Because, you know, if you talk to people who just lost them, you're like, well, I'll never get that back. So what kind of hope are you referring to?
With her, I mean, her story was really, really interesting, because she hadn't really been feeling sad or depressed all that time. She'd simply just kind of cut her husband out of her life. It was most peculiar. I mean, I've never met anything like it before or since, but her husband was just it was almost like he'd never existed, and she just got on with things. But after 12 years, it did catch her up, and she did go to see her doctor. And luckily her husband had a hobby. And I won't say what it was, but he had a hobby which meant making things. And I said to her, are there things around the house that he made as part of his hobby? And so, yeah, so I said, well, put them in a carrier bag and bring them next week and we'll talk about them. And we had a lovely session, and she talked about him and his shed and his untidiness, and we laughed, and she remembered things. And it was actually about bringing him back to life, bringing him back into her life, so that she could then process his death. It was really, really rewarding work. And to start with, she really didn't care whether she lived or died. And after a few weeks, she was really, really keen on life again. And then about 3 or 4 years afterwards, I was at a dance. We often go to dance, but I was at a dance. And she rushed up to me and she hugged me. She nearly knocked me over. And she was just so happy. It made so much difference to her life.
Wow.
She just come and thank me.
Now I'm convinced to go into grief counseling. That's a better recovery rate than CBT, you know, but I guess because it's also something that we all have to face eventually, you know.
Yes.
Death or loss, yeah. Right? I mean,
yeah.
And how to face that. It's, we're not really taught, are we, to how to do that. We're just taught to kind of like go for the goals, right? Like keep pursuing. We're not really taught very well on how to deal with loss.
I mean, I don't know about your culture, but certainly in Western culture, we are not taught. We're taught very much to kind of avoid it and not talk about it at all. We're gradually trying to get it more talked about. And so there's a movement in the UK for bereavement cafes and grief cafes. We've got one on Wednesday, first one we're initiating. So we're just going to invite people along for a cup of tea and a biscuit and to talk about bereavement and loss and grief and so on. Some of the people there will be bereaved. Some people will be there that want to help other people that have been bereaved. So we don't know how it's going to go yet, but we did a pilot some time ago and it was a very successful day. So this is the first time we're doing them regularly, and it will be really interesting to see if we can get people to talk a lot more about grief. And
yeah. Well, I'll follow up with you on that. I mean, that's a great A great idea. Thank you for this lovely conversation, despite the somber topic. But just to end, what advice would you give our listeners on how to help other people with their grief? Because I was talking to someone today, and it was also, I don't know what to do, and what if I say something wrong? And that's, I think, a very common concern. And what would you tell them?
It's really difficult, and it's sometimes it's easier to sort of sometimes it's easier to tell people what not to say, and so sort of not say things like, oh, well, they're at peace now, or oh, they had a good life, and so on, or they're in a better place. And a lot of people say those things because they don't know what to say. And I think the answer, I think it's right, that it's about just being aware of what is actually going on for you personally, not trying to come out with a good answer. And so quite often I will say to people, I don't know what to say. And I say that quite a lot, you know, I don't know what to say about that at the moment. I think that can be really much more helpful than trying to come up with something, something about just being really genuine and saying, and if you think you can be there for that person, you know, again, a lot of people will say, I'm always here for you. If you're going to say that, you really need to mean it. And you sometimes need to then follow that up. So it can be, you know, I mean, I've got friends and neighbors that have been bereaved, and if I say to them, I'm here for you, I mean it, and I will go out of my way sometimes to contact them to see how they're doing, to stop and speak to them and ask them. But I think sometimes people are just, I don't know about where you are, but people cross the road and on the other side to avoid talking to people sometimes because
it's awkward, right? Because And I guess what you're saying is, like, we don't need to fill the silence. We don't need to fill the pain.
No.
And it's okay to
We can't sort out the pain. The pain is there anyway. We can't fix it. And I think sometimes it's acknowledging we can't fix it. But we can be alongside that person.
Then it's about for us to tolerate our own discomfort in order to be helpful to that other person.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, John. I noticed that again. It was such an upbeat voice at the end. But I think, you know, our conversation, despite it being somber, there was moments of levity and moments of fun, because I think when connecting on something so existentially relevant, then we did come in and out of the conversation, right? We're also noticing different things. But if our focus is not just on this topic, and that seems to mimic very well what you're talking about, the process of bereavement, right? We're in and out, we're switching back and forth, the dual process. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, John. I'll try that
thank
again.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for talking to me, and it was a real pleasure.
That's been great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Being Human podcast. To find out more about Relate Malaysia's online therapy services, visit us at www.relate.com.my or email us at inquires@relate.com.my. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, remember, we are all more human than we are otherwise. Be kind to yourself and take care.